Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. Today I'll be speaking with Garth Risk-Hallberg, author of City on Fire, this season's biggest debut novel. And Chelsea Clinton talks about her new book for young readers, It's Your World. Get informed, get inspired, and get going. If you haven't heard of Garth Risk-Hallberg, listen up, and you will. He's the talk of publishing these days with a $2 million deal for his first novel, City on Fire, about New York in the 70s and the Great Blackout of 1977. Garth was born in Denham Springs, Louisiana, raised in North Carolina, and now lives in Brooklyn with his wife and two sons. City on Fire hits bookstores this week. Garth, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. In some sense, I feel like I've been living it since I was born, but it's wonderful to finally officially have arrived at the real capital R, capital L, Reading Life.
Well, I have to say first, I am just in awe of this book. It's such a grand achievement on every level, the sweep, the scope, and yet the intimate characterization and your gorgeous writing style. It's a book you sort of live in while you're reading it. And so I imagine you did when you were writing it.
Those were always the kinds of books that I loved to read the most as a reader. And I have lowercase c Catholic taste as a reader, so I sort of read pretty broadly. But the things that I have always loved to read the most are the books that you just kind of climb inside and live in for a couple of weeks. And I didn't know if I'd ever have the chance to write one. But when the kind of inspiration for this came along and I recognized in the material that that's what it would have to be, the idea that I might be reviving and paying homage to the kinds of immersive books that sustained me as a kid and a teenager and in my 20s, you know, from Lord of the Rings to David Copperfield, was a thrill.
Now, it's such a love song to New York City, and that was your dream as a young man, wasn't it, to come to New York and live there and write?
Well, I think cities more broadly, you know, even before New York, because I grew up in a relatively small town in eastern North Carolina, you know, really several hours away from the nearest city, the first few cities that I visited as a kid were probably New Orleans to see grandparents. We took a family trip to London, and my mother had friends from her high school in Covington who ended up in Washington, D.C. And those early contacts with cities, with the kind of explosive diversity of people who make up cities and the scale and grandeur of them, kindled some kind of romance in me. And pretty early on, that got tangled up with the romance of New York City more specifically, which I think I was probably getting from like Harriet the Spy and The Muppets Take Manhattan. And then you get to be a teenager and you're reading Jack Kerouac and Tom Wolfe. So somehow my dream of New York distilled more particularly a larger dream of cities and the way that they inspire all kinds of connections and all manner of disconnections between people.
Well, this is a novel about the many varieties of the American dream, from amassing great wealth to becoming known as a great artist or a great writer and achieving fame and making a mark on the greatest of American cities. So it's so interesting to me that there's this subset of the American dream that focuses on New York as its mecca, really.
Yes, and I mean, it's interesting. There's a great essay that I adore by E.B. White called This is New York.
Yes.
And it was written in 1948, just after the end of World War II, when the city was really, in a lot of ways, soaring in its ability to extend the dream to people from all classes and all places in the world, but also a time when the nuclear bomb, the firebombing of Dresden, these things that exposed the terrible fragility of the urban idea as well. And that essay was circulating a lot after September 11th. It just has a timeless and somehow unsentimental yet romantic vision of what cities mean to people. And in that essay, he talks about the three kinds of New Yorkers. He says there's the native, the person who's born and raised here, the commuter, and the settler, the person who comes from somewhere else. So in the mix of characters in this novel, there are some natives, but there are also many characters who come from far away and sort of renew the dream of the city, the American dream, as you put it, by bringing, you know, whatever they're bringing from rural Georgia or from the suburbs of Los Angeles. So I would hope that provides a sort of complicating picture of the American dream, because, of course, one of the great dreams you can have is just to make an impact on your fellow man. You know, it doesn't have to be great wealth or great art. You know, it can be as simple as the connection between neighbors or the building of a community, however fragile.
But it's also so interesting the way you show the emotional range of people's reactions to the city where they live. You know, do you choose the city? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Do you destroy it? Do you take advantage of it? That I found really interesting as well.
And that balance between embracing and rebelling against, or between creation and destruction, is something that I think no matter where people live, I mean, that tension is an essential tension in everyone's life, whether it's in your relationship with your family or your relationship with your career or your relationship with your coworkers or your community. And so to me, the city was like a laboratory for observing those tensions in exaggerated and heightened form. Sometimes it's easier to see things when they're a little bit exaggerated. So the fact that everything is bigger in the city can still give us some access to, you know, universal things that everybody goes through.
And one of the things about cities that we've all learned in recent years is that eventually we'll face some sort of breakdown in order, whether it's a blackout or a hurricane or a flood or an earthquake or a terrorist attack. I mean, disorder and chaos are coming for us all eventually.
And there's something in that E.B. White essay about the way that bringing all these people together in this great shared enterprise almost defies fate. You know, it sort of draws the perverse dreams of madmen who would loose the lightning. And then, of course, you know, in New Orleans, you've got this series of natural disasters. My mom lived through Camille and Betsy. But if the city itself is a kind of laboratory in which to observe heightened and exaggerated the tensions that are at the core of the most important choices every person makes, then the city in a time of disaster is sort of a laboratory within the laboratory. Everything is even more sharp and focused and on the surface. And I remember in the days and weeks and months after September 11th, I was living in Washington, D.C., which of course had also been a victim of the attacks, and still trying to get to New York. But watching it bring out of people both the best and the worst things that at other times we carry around sort of in hazier form or somewhere deeper, more hidden in our souls. The kind of emotional vulnerability that makes for transformations in people's lives. And I remember watching Katrina and sort of seeing that same thing. I think there was a heat wave in New York, and one of my neighbors, you know, had family in New Orleans. And on day three or day four after the hurricane hit, we're just talking to each other, you know, like, can you believe this? And watching endlessly the news on TV, just hoping for some sort of good news. And you got that. You got incredible acts of generosity that people ordinarily don't have room for in their lives, you know, because you got to drop the kids off at school and you've got to go to the bank and pick up your dry cleaning. And then you also witness some of what's most terrible in people. And those are the energies that animate the novel.
Now, your characters range from moneyed wheeler dealers to cops, reporters, and punk rockers, art gallery owners. He was one of my favorite characters, and artists and writers. This is such a broad canvas, and I'm curious which character you feel is closest to you.
Well, they're all me. In some form, I figured out very early on that one of the risks I was taking was in trying to write about experiences that were more or less remote from my own, but that somehow I felt belonged to me or that I had a right to try to write about. I had started to feel that American storytelling had renounced the thing that Dickens does so well, which is the sort of ambition and desire to not just write about one's own experience, but to try to empathize with people other than oneself. And I just knew that had to be part of this book. And what I figured out early on was I have to figure out how these characters can all be me. What parts of myself, obviously somehow unconsciously, I'm drawn to this character because, you know, we have something in common. And what is it? And I would get to where I would think like, oh, this is the part of me that's sort of neurotic and repressed. And this is what happens if you push my buttons, I turn into this character. And, you know, I just sort of gave them names and went with it. So they're all me, but in different moods, I feel close to different characters.
Well, there's this wonderful moment when Mercer describes how he's becoming a writer and he imagines being interviewed for the Paris Review.
Oh, which is just heavily ironic.
I know. And I love it when he said, but I don't know if this is ironic. And so I wanted to explore again the old idea that the novel might, you know, teach us about something, about everything. And you do have so much of everything in this book. It's an amazing accomplishment.
Well, I was embarrassed to put that scene on the page of the aspiring writer imagining himself being interviewed. So there is a fair amount of irony in it, but I guess underneath, perhaps the irony is camouflage under which I can display some of the things that I really care about that I think that books do.
Now, this novel was so many years in the making, and, you know, 900 pages, that's the other thing everybody comments on, is its length. And I have to wonder, were there ever moments when you thought, am I insane? Is this really going to work? It's such a sustained effort.
Well, the whole first 3 years that I was writing it, I assumed it was unpublishable. This was right amidst the financial crisis, and everyone was talking about the shortening of attention spans because of the internet. And I was just tied to this project by love or the passion that I felt for it. And the fact that it just seemed insane that anyone would want a book that was going to be as long as Bleak House, which is sort of what I knew going in, it somehow freed me to kind of dream bigger and wilder and to do all kinds of things that I might have second-guessed if I was writing because I thought it was going to be published in this way and, you know, oh, you shouldn't take these risks because, you know, it's going to be out there. It just wasn't even a possibility in my mind, to be honest. And it was actually hard to learn to move beyond personal ambition and just be driven by the art of it, I guess. But somehow you're always writing for a reader, you know, even if the reader is an imaginary person, you're not writing just for yourself somehow. And whoever this imaginary reader was who might find the book in my desk drawer long after I was dead, you know, I knew that because of the length of it, it had to be fun and it had to deliver pleasure. You know, it's so easy to shut a 900-page book on page 15 and walk away and read three others instead. And so that really challenged me as a storyteller to think about the range of pleasures that great fiction affords. And not to say that I managed to get them all on the page, but that became part of the ambition, you know, to talk about all these things that felt meaningful to me, but in a way that would also feel propulsively and compulsively exciting for the reader. As excited, I was hoping that this imaginary reader might be as excited as I felt by the possibilities of the book. So it remains, I think, a slightly insane publishing project. But on the other hand, I can look back. I can look at my bookshelves right now and I see Harry Potter and I see Elena Ferrante.
Yeah.
And then I look at my 18th century section, or 19th century section, and I see Middlemarch, and I see Bleak House, and I see Brothers Karamazov, and I see books that I have loved and loved living inside. And probably I won't ever know if this book comes remotely close to being loved the way that I have loved those books. But to just be able to get in the ring with them and dance and do what they do, and to imagine that the novel might be that central in people's lives for the few weeks that they're reading it, and that they might just get to climb inside and live in a world and love doing it, is its own kind of reward for me.
One of the things I love about this book is that there is such a conspiracy of hope that surrounds it. It's almost more than a purely big business deal or a big arrival, because everybody who reads it loves it and wants everybody else to read it.
I love that phrase, conspiracy of hope, to describe actually what is binding the book together, because the inside the book I stole this from Faulkner, who I love, you know, and the Hamlet in particular. You know, the plot is also a plot. You know, there's a lot of little conspiracies and little plots drawing people together, and that's sort of Dickensian or Dostoevskian tradition. But really, what's holding a lot of these characters who have it in themselves to be such good people, if they just could move past all the things that prevent us from being good people, is a kind of conspiracy of hope. And that maybe is the most beautiful definition of a city I've ever heard. A city is a conspiracy of hope.
So true. Ah, well, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure for me after loving this book. So thanks. We've been talking with Garth Riske-Hallberg, whose brilliant new novel is City on Fire. You can meet him Sunday, October 18th from 3 to 5 at Garden District Bookshop. Don't miss this book. Garth, congratulations, and thank you so much.
Thank you to you and your listeners.
Chelsea Clinton is the vice chair of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, and her special interest is in work related to women and girls and empowering a new generation of leaders. She's also a new mom to daughter Charlotte, who just had her first birthday. And today we're talking about her new book, It's Your World. Get informed, get inspired, and get going. Chelsea, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I'm so happy that you invited me to join you on The Reading Life.
Now, this is a very ambitious and comprehensive book. You have four sections, the economy, human rights, body issues, as well as the environment. And this is pretty challenging stuff for young readers.
I think it's important that we engage young people in these issues, partly because, at least for the young people that I know, they're asking to be engaged, and they're probably more perceptive to these issues, to kind of questions about health, questions about climate change, questions about poverty and inequality in our country and around the world than I think often adults think they are. So I certainly hope that this book answers some of the questions that I've heard from young people and helps empower them with what they can do in their own families, in their own communities, and in our world to make a difference in the areas where they really feel most passionate.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I like about this book is that it goes from the global to the very personal.
Well, I think that's important because I think that's how we all lead our lives. And certainly when I talk to young people, the concerns are as varied as probably, Susan, like what you and I hear from our friends or in our own families. They're concerned about what's happening in their own homes, in their schools, in their neighborhoods. But also they're concerned about climate change, which is happening all over the world, or endangered species like elephants or pandas, even though we don't have any elephants or pandas native to America. You know, I certainly wrote this book in response to what I was hearing kind of young people being curious or concerned about. And you're absolutely right, Susan, that stretches across sort of the very local to the very global.
Well, one of the other things I enjoyed about it is that you break it down so gracefully and easily, and every section ends with suggested actions so that kids have somewhere to go with all this information.
That was really important to me, partly because I read a book when I was 10 or 11 that had a profound impact on me. And I don't know if you remember this book, but it was called 50 Simple Things Kids Can Do to Save the Earth. And it had such a big impact on me for a couple of reasons. One, it treated me seriously as someone who deserved to know about climate change and pollution and acid rain, even though I was only 10 or 11. But it also empowered me with really practical suggestions of what I could do as a little girl at that time in Arkansas to make a difference, whether through a recycling program or cutting up the plastic rings around soda cans so that marine wildlife wouldn't choke on them in places like the Gulf Coast down in Louisiana.
Right.
And so, you know, when I was thinking about writing It's Your World, it was really important to me to aspire to have that same impact on at least one kid. And having that same impact requires sort of giving kids practical suggestions about what they can do to really make a difference.
Well, one of the great things is that any kid can write a letter to a congressman or do a school report on an endangered species or step up when they see bullying. And so I think this really is a very empowering book for young readers. And it's funny to me because it's almost as if you found this writing voice of your own. I mean, it's conversational. It's a little challenging. The book is informed, but it's very warm at the same time.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I certainly hope that would be kind of what readers would experience, because I feel strongly that the book Treat Kids Seriously is deserving to kind of know what we know and also what we don't know about these issues, but that it also be accessible. And that's partly why I include so many stories of young people and a few older people who are making a difference, and also why I share my own stories kind of when I think they're relevant and will help people understand either why I care about something or why I think something's important. So thank you for saying that. I'm glad that came through.
Well, I love that you have examples from all over the world. And I couldn't help noticing that young Isaac from Keithville, Louisiana, was one of your examples.
And I met Isaac, actually, when I was in Atlanta, because he's now a freshman at Morehouse.
Oh, my gosh.
Which was great, which was so much fun. I was so tickled when he came to my book signing, and I got to give him a hug and thank him for allowing me to include his story in the book, and also even more for doing his work that now continues, even though he's off at college. There are other young people who have continued his program.
We should say that he looked around Keithville and he noticed the hunger in his community, and he became the founder of an organization called Game Changers Tackling Hunger, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Absolutely. And that he leveraged existing organizations, his 4-H mentors and friends, and also the local food banks and food pantries. So he didn't feel like he had to reinvent the wheel. He just knew he could make the wheel kind of work a little bit better, and that it was an area where young people, whether they had grown up on a farm like he did or not, could really make a difference. And I think it's very cool that he tried to do something, did something, and did it so well that it's continuing even though he's in college today.
One of the other things that's always interested me in books for kids, especially fiction, of course, is that so much of it is concerned with power. I mean, the whole process of growing up is learning how much power an individual can have and what its proper use might be. And I think this is a book that shows that for young people, that provides a roadmap to making a difference.
Well, thank you. I certainly believe each of us can make a difference. And with a little bit of information, any kid can make a difference. And as you mentioned earlier, anyone can write a letter or send a tweet or join an online petition or stand up for a friend who's being bullied or create safe space for a friend to talk about body image issues or concerns about sexism or discrimination. You know, all of us can do that. And so I certainly hope that recognizing that we can do that is the first part of being empowered. And then actually doing that, hopefully, is further empowering and leads each of us, however old or young we may be, to then realizing kind of what a gift that empowerment is and what more we can and hopefully then should do with that.
And I'm sure this work has taken on a new urgency for you now that you have Charlotte.
Absolutely. I didn't know I could care more passionately about the issues I care about. And then I became a mom and somehow found that I could. And I didn't know that I could believe so strongly that every child can make a difference until realizing, you know, the children and the young people that I hope will read It's Your World are going to be so influential in the world that Charlotte grows up in. I mean, they're going to be the people that she looks up to, that she is following behind. So I certainly hope this is positively empowering, not only because I think it's the right thing for every kid to have that opportunity, but also because I think it's the right thing for Charlotte.
Well, it's a terrific book. We've been talking with Chelsea Clinton, whose new book is It's Your World. Get informed, get inspired, and get going. You can meet her Tuesday, October 13th at 5:30 at Octavia Books. This is a ticketed event. Chelsea, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you very much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Chelsea Clinton, signs It's Your World, Get Informed, Get Inspired, and Get Going, Tuesday, October 13th at 5:30 at Octavia Books. Cynthia Lejeune Noble signs A Confederacy of Dunces cookbook, recipes from Ignatius J. Riley's New Orleans, Tuesday, October 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. John Pope discusses and signs Getting Off at Elysian Fields, obituaries from the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Tuesday, October 13th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, and again Wednesday, October 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael Hirsch signs Extraordinary People, a semi-comprehensive guide to some of the world's most fascinating individuals, Thursday, October 15th at 5:30 at Octavia Books. Noted children's author Jack Antos discusses and signs The Trouble in Me, as well as other books in the Joey Pigsa series, Thursday, October 15th at 6:30 at the St. Tammany Parish Library in Slidell. Photographer Tina Freeman discusses Artist Spaces New Orleans, Thursday, October 15th at 7 at the Nix Library on Carrollton. Photographer Carrie McCafferty launches her new book, New Orleans at Night, Friday, October 16th at 6 at the New Orleans Museum of Art. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses The Story of Land and Sea by Katie Simpson Smith, Saturday, October 17th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Garth Risk-Hallberg, signs City on Fire, Sunday, October 18th from 3 to 5 at Garden District Bookshop. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, October 18th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Novelist Elizabeth Sanders signs The Last Light, Monday, October 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. The St. Charles Parish Library in Destrehan will be hosting a number of author programs during Friends of the Library Week, October 18th through 24th. On October 19th at 6, Lori Rader Day, author of The Black Hour and Little Pretty Things, will present a mystery writing boot camp. On October 20th at 6, Rader Day will speak at the Friends of St. Charles Library annual meeting. The library is located at 160 West Campus Drive in Destrehan. For more info, contact them at 985-764-2366. Michael Alenzell discusses Run Baby Run, Tuesday, October 20th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. That's part of the Coffee and Conversation series sponsored by the library and the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Also coming up, the Friends of Jefferson Public Library hold their semi-annual Big Book Sale from Thursday, October 15th to Sunday, October 18th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Thursday through Saturday, October 15th through 17th, and noon to 5, Sunday, October 18th. Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans presented by the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society, celebrates its 25th anniversary. It takes place October 29th through November 2nd, and appropriately, the theme this year is Out of This World, the Otherworldly in Literature and Life. Featured guests include psychic Carrie Roy channeling William Faulkner, Mary Arno, John Biganay, Elise Blackwell, Brian Boyles, Lori Carlson, Jack Davis, Sally Ann Glassman, Sybil Morial, Michael Murphy, Tom Piazza, Bruce Jones, Julie Smith, Tony Dunbar, Mary Helen Lagasse, and Jenny Tilbury. For more information, check out wordsmusic.org. Sad news for our literary community. Maple Street Bookshop owner Gladden Scott has announced that the venerable Uptown Institution will close at the end of the year. Over its half century, the shop has served as an incubator for great booksellers, a support system for local writers, the setting for storyteller Colleen Sally's charming Visa commercial, and a welcome stop for families for Saturday morning story times. It's nourished a love of reading and a celebration of writing, and we are lucky to have had it as long as we did. It was the first bookshop I ever visited in New Orleans, and it was the place I came out as a witch during Halloween parties. And my children practically learned to read from the children's bookseller Cindy Dyke, always ready with a quick laugh and a good recommendation. Thanks, Maple Street, for hanging in there so long. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.